you, Derek. Are the microphones on? Can everyone hear me? Look at that. Great. I'm vaguely talking into a microphone. That was the nicest description of my job description I've heard in a really long time, so I might write that down later. We are going to talk about inequality, and what we're going to do is talk for about 40 minutes and then open the floor for questions from you. I say questions. If you get up and talk for a minute and don't have a question at the end of it, I will stop you talking. I'm nice that way. So to my far right is John Hartley, who splits his time between the corporate world, the not-for-profit world, and the church. He is a director, chairman, and minister. Please make him welcome.
Thank you.
Next to him is Max Rashbrook, who is a journalist, author, and researcher, the author of Wealth in New Zealand, editor of Inequality and New Zealand Crisis, and research associate at the Institute for Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria University, and was described in my hearing today as a bit of an expert. Please make Max welcome. I said it in a much nicer way than I just did, I promise. And then right next to me is Eric Crampton, who is a lecturer in, well, was a lecturer in economics at the University of Canterbury until 2014, and is now the head of research at the New Zealand Institute. And we've just had a long conversation about housing, which I suspect is going to come up again. Please make Eric welcome. So I have told the three of them that the less I talk, the better. So I'm going to open with a fairly complicated question. What do we mean when we talk about inequality? Eric, you can go first.
Sure. There are two basic ways of looking at it as I see it. The first one is the one that makes most of the media headlines, and that'll be inequality in outcomes when people wind up having different incomes or consumption or wealth. Another way of looking at it is inequalities in treatment. So how government treats different groups, whether different communities have access to the same quality of schooling, the same quality of hospitals, same access to the justice system, same treatment by police. I tend to worry a little bit more about the latter than the former, because I think that if you get the processes right, the outcomes wind up being a little bit more justifiable, but people differ on that. I do think that some of the concerns around outcome differences come down to some process problems, especially around housing and education, but we'll get back to that.
There's been a lot of headlines in the last 4 or 5 years talking about New Zealand's inequality problem. You've taken exception to a lot of those headlines. Do you think there's been more headlines than there is actually data to back that up?
Oh, sure. So there's a whole pile of different measures of inequality, but whichever one you choose, Ministry of Social Development's Brian Perry says that there's been no change in inequality for about the last 2 decades. That's consistent across measures, and it differs substantially from the track record in the United States, where inequality has risen substantially. So the best data that's out there shows that it's been flat. If you look at top income shares, they are much lower here than in the United States, for example. Top 1% earns less than half as much of overall income as it does in the United States, for example. And there's some really interesting work by Brian Easton, where he was looking back over incomes going back to the 1930s and properly accounting for things like the tax changes in the 1980s, where dividend imputation changed. And there he's been showing just this long-term decline in the share of earnings going to those on top incomes over the past decades. So if we contrast that with New Zealand Herald headlines, where they just started skyrocketing after 2009, I think what's gone on is that we've imported an American narrative about what's going on in America's data because we get so much news out of the U.S. I think we've also experienced a real crisis in housing in Auckland. And whenever you turn something like housing into a zero-sum game, of course people start getting really nervous about people who have more money than they do because they're going to outbid them at a house auction. The problem there is that we have broken how we treat zoning and council financing and infrastructure financing. The problem isn't inequality. We do have some horribly unequal outcomes in housing, and some, well, it shows up in the child poverty stats. If you look at, again, Brian Perry's work from the Ministry of Social Development, child poverty on a fixed line measure dropped by about 60% of what it was from 1982 to 2014 on a before housing cost measure. If you take it after housing costs, it rose. We have a housing crisis. We don't have an income inequality crisis.
Okay, Max, what did Eric leave out?
I think you have to look a bit more closely at the story of the last 30 years. So
between the mid-80s and the mid-2000s, New Zealand had the biggest increase in the gap between rich and poor of any developed country. Over that period of time, well, take it forward right even into today, incomes for people in the upper echelons of New Zealand society have doubled after tax, whereas they have barely increased for people at the bottom. So a very, very significant widening of those imbalances between rich and poor, biggest increase in the developed world in that period. That trend sort of peters out in the early 2000s. Now, Eric is quite right to say that the level of inequality we have now, so the imbalance between rich and poor, the level we have presently is about the same as it was when the Labour government took power in 1999. What that obscures, however, is that there have been different trends within that time. And again, if you look across all the different measures of inequality, and there's various things you can take, you can look at the difference between people in the top tenth and the poorest tenth, or the top fifth and the poorest fifth, various whole lot of different measures. Across all of them, what you see under Labour, so in the 2000s, particularly in the late 2000s, is a slight decrease in inequality. And that's, and the household incomes report that Eric referred to says very clearly that's mostly due to working for families and a couple of other measures. So there was a, not a strong, but a slight decline in inequality in that period. What we've seen since the global financial crisis is a slight increase in inequality on all measures, both before housing costs and after housing costs. So although it's true that there hasn't been an explosion in recent times, we have lost the progress that we were making on inequality in the late 2000s. And I also think it's certainly true that housing is exacerbating the problems we already face. There is a very significant housing problem, as Eric's pointed out, particularly in Auckland, but it's far from the only problem. There are lots of different measures of poverty, but on one of them, the percentage of the population who are living on less than 60% of the average income, which is typically taken as a poverty line because that's about the point at which people really start struggling, they've got less than 60% of average incomes. The number of New Zealanders who are living in poverty below that line has increased from about 13-14% in the mid-80s to about 20% now. And that's before you get anywhere near housing costs. So firstly, very large numbers of New Zealanders are poor, even without having to think about housing, and that number has increased significantly even before you get into housing. So yes, there's definitely a housing problem, but there's a colossal inequality problem that sits on top of.
But assuming that doesn't necessarily mean that society has become more unequal, does it? Just because there are more poor people does not mean that there are more rich people at the same time.
Well, that gets complicated. They are analytically separate concepts, poverty and inequality.
But the poverty measure you chose is really an inequality measure.
Well, it's a measure of relative poverty.
Exactly.
And there is a long, very long history of debates about what constitutes poverty and how do you measure it. And people who are real experts in this, and people like Jonathan Boston in the audience, know that these debates get enormously complicated and there is no simple answer on them. But where the household incomes report, for instance, arrives at is the idea that there is an absolute, there is a core of absolute poverty, some very, very basic things that no one should be without. But beyond that, poverty is fundamentally relative. It is, and this is the household incomes report definition, the failure to achieve a minimally acceptable life. And this is the idea that, and this goes back to Adam Smith, who pointed out that for people not to be poor, they have to be able to hold their head up in society. They have to be able to have the things that, in his words, decent people, it is not credible for decent people to be without. And in his period, the example he gives is that was a clean linen shirt. That was one of the things you had to have to not be poor. Now, that standard is very different now because, of course, time has moved on and we live in a more prosperous society. But people fundamentally need to be able to participate in society. It is shameful, it is degrading not to be able to. And so you're in poverty if you don't have the resources you need to achieve that minimally acceptable way of living.
But when you get into that kind of a measure, we start looking at inequality, as I properly conceive it, as being a function of consumption rather than of income, market income or disposable income. And inequality in consumption, which John Creedy's excellent work from Treasury and also from the University of Victoria at Wellington shows, that consumption inequality is now lower than it was in 1983.
So let's just explain what you mean by consumption inequality.
So it's really important to get some of these down. So we start off with market income inequality, and that's differences in how much people get paid in whatever job they're in or in whatever tax and whatever job they're in. Then there's an inequality in disposable income after taxes and transfers. So the government takes a lot of money from rich people, gives a lot of money to poor people already. So whenever you're listening to debates around inequality, if somebody's giving you a market income inequality measure and then arguing for more tax and transfers, they're kind of lying to you, because you need to start with the measure that already accounts for current government programs, and that's the after tax and transfer one. Next, we want to look at real consumption, because people save money in bad years when they're rich enough to do so, and they dissave in bad years. So inequality in consumption gets really at differences in lived experience, I think. So the Household Economics Survey surveys everybody, I think it's biweekly or monthly, says what did you spend on a whole pile of different categories of goods. Inequality in consumption says what was the differences in different households' expenditures over those periods. And when Creedy looked back through that and made the appropriate adjustments for changes in a household composition, it's lower now than it was in the early 80s. Government redistribution, as Max rightly pointed out, working for families does a big part of the job already in equalizing incomes, disposable incomes after tax and transfer. I think on work by Ball, Aziz, and Creedy, again, more University of Victoria work, decile 9 and 10 families are contributing about a net $50,000 into the public purse over and above what they consume in government services. Deciles 1 and 2 households are getting about $20,000 in tax and transfers, and then decile 3 and 4 get about $30,000. We already have a substantial amount of redistribution in the system. We need to account for that when we're thinking about how policy should change, because we need to start from where the baseline really is. And consumption really is the right measure, I think.
So the 2016 Ministry of Social Development Household Income Report showed that while income inequality has not increased in the past decade, people are spending, and we've already talked about housing, but basically significantly more of their pay on keeping a roof over their head. So the report said that the lowest 20% of earners spent 54% of their income on housing in 2015, compared to just 29% in the late 1980s. So leaving aside the problem of housing as a general thing, those people clearly have less money to spend on stuff.
Oh yeah, and the consumption measure will include
and
what you're spending.
Save.
The consumption measure includes what you're spending on housing.
Can I just come in briefly on the consumption point? I mean, again, you know, these debates are long and complex, and I think it would be pretty strange to throw everything else out the door and argue just need to talk about consumption, especially because it's quite a flawed measure. I mean, in fact, my understanding is the Creedy and Ball stuff is expenditure inequality, strictly, rather than consumption. And the thing is, well, you know, I mean, different groups may be spending relatively similar amounts, but if you have a vast increase in income inequality, as we have had, then people at the top will be able to save very large amounts out of their income after the spending they've made, and that stores up and that turns into wealth and that gets passed through the generations and that reinforces inequality. Whereas people at the lower end may be propping up their spending by unsustainable borrowing or by running down assets. And indeed, I always remember that in the run-up to the global financial crisis, people who I think were concerned to not want to have such a big debate about inequality were spent quite a bit of time pointing out that consumption inequality in America in the early and mid-2000s was pretty flat, and so there was nothing to worry about. And we all know how that unwound, because people were so vastly in debt, and that was propping things up in that sense. So I mean, the Household Incomes Report does say it'd be useful to additionally look a bit at consumption inequality, but it's very clear that it's not the main show in town, and that report is the gold standard. I'd also just say on housing, it's very true that people, particularly at the poorer end, are having to pay an awful lot of their income on housing costs. But for the poorest, you really look at the poorest families, the ones who are deemed to be spending far too much money on housing, far more than is sustainable. The big increase in the number of families in that category has not come recently. There are no more families in that category now than there were in the mid-90s. The big increase in people in that category comes in the period in the late 80s and the early 90s, and what's happening then is that people's incomes are being cut, people are on benefits, and market rents are being introduced for state housing tenants.
But
so that is the oftentimes, when we think it's about housing, it actually turns out to be about other social policy elements.
But that graph goes up with incomes in that recession, then comes down as incomes rose, and it's risen again since. So you're comparing two points that are at peaks, and you're ignoring that it dropped and came back up.
I think you're thinking about
different data. I'll show it to you right now.
While you look up that graph, I want to come to you, John. Why is it important that we talk about inequality and we don't just talk about poverty? Or is it?
First of all, let me just... unlike my colleagues, I'm not an economist and I don't have all the statistics that they have. I've served on the board of ASB Bank. I'm a commercial director. But I'm also chairman of a very large social enterprise, a global social enterprise with 32 countries. And I'm chairman of the City Mission. And my first reference point here is that everything that these gentlemen are talking about is not a statistic, it's a face. Mm-hmm. It's a person. And with due respect, if we never take it back to the person, then we really start to lose the point of the debate. The second point is that actually it's not just the person, it's the one in front of you. So, for example, in the City Mission, we find ourselves now in a position of having to deal with the issues that my colleagues are debating in real time, in difficult circumstances, and without resources to match. And it's very hard to help somebody who cannot find a home to find a home. It is extremely difficult to find a job for someone who wants a job. It is just the fact of life. And we spend our time walking with people through difficult circumstances, and we will walk with them for as long as possible. But with another hat on, I'm part of the Anglican Church, I'm a minister, and I reflected on the topic of debate, and it struck me that actually, well, it didn't strike me. I went and looked in the sacred texts of a number of our faiths, and the word inequality doesn't appear. Nowhere does it appear. But what is implied is something about exclusion and inclusion. And I'm very much more attracted to the idea that somehow we change the narrative to who is excluded. Because exclusion is about walls. It's about barriers. It's about keeping people out. It's about not letting people into my world, because I want that exclusion to survive. You know, inclusion is a much more comprehensive and demanding and loving concept. It's hard, but that is what actually I think we're called to. So I just want to finish with one thing, which is part of my faith, which is Jesus doesn't talk about inequality. He doesn't talk about equality. He talks about bringing life in all its fullness. And a full life to you is a different from a full life to me. So let me give you an example. In a small goat farm 50 kilometres outside Lusaka, I sat with a farmer who had borrowed some money from our microfinance institution. And he had bought two bicycles and three goats. And he was starting to run a little fish farm. He was absolutely content with his life. And he was living in what you would see and I would see as abject poverty. He didn't have running water. He didn't have proper sanitation. But he was so proud to tell me about the fact that he could now cycle to the market 50 kilometres away to deliver a live goat. He was content. For him, he had a full life. And so I just leave that as a thought from a biblical reflection.
No, I don't disagree with any of that.
Yes, but it's very difficult to segue from a live goat to... But I'm going to do it with Jim Bolger. So, not to pimp a Radio New Zealand product, but if you haven't seen it, we have a series at the moment called The Ninth Floor, which is long-form, hour-long interviews with former Prime Ministers of New Zealand. And last week, Jim Bolger's one was released. And I finally got a chance to listen to it today. And Max, this goes back to what you were saying about the late 80s and early 90s. Bolger basically said, have you both listened to this? Shit. Jenny Shipley, who's One Tomorrow, is also very interesting. But he basically, Bolger basically said that the neoliberal policies of the of his term did not work. They failed to produce economic growth, and what growth there has been has gone to the few at the top. He said those policies failed.
He's been severely wrong. There has been substantial income growth. If you look over the period, I think that it's about 30% real income growth for households from on the lower deciles. If you look 91 through, I think it's 2014, we've had also substantial growth that's been widely shared from the 20th to the 90th percentiles. There's been higher growth in the top percentile, or the top decile, but 20th through 90th has been broadly shared. We're a lot wealthier than we used to be, and it's not just the run-up in house prices. You look at the things that we've got access to now that just simply would have been impossible without those reforms.
But if I am the child of one of those people in the early 1990s who lost their job and therefore did not have access to education, did not have access to healthcare, did not have or good access to healthcare, did not have the opportunities that someone who still had their job in those times, are we not talking about some kind of generational poverty that wouldn't have existed were it not for those changes?
There could have been better transitional assistance with the restructuring in the 80s.
Yeah. Exactly what Jeffrey Palmer said.
Yeah, that could and possibly should have been done. But we should not underestimate the benefits we continue to get from the reforms we had. Just look at how clean the tax system here is compared to nightmares abroad. And that's one of the legacies of the 80s. It's harder to do stupid tax rorts here than elsewhere. It's clean, it's nice. Harder than elsewhere.
So, but Max, your argument is exactly what I just said, right? That the what happened to incomes in that time is what's creating a lot of what's happening now.
Yeah, I think, I mean, whenever somebody like Bolger says something sweeping like that, I mean, there will always be, you know, an extent to which it's accurate and to which it's not accurate. And Eric's quite true that over the long run, there have been income gains, not just for people at the top. I think what Bolger means, though, is that specific period where, you know, between 1984 and 1989, and again, it's from the Household Incomes Report, everybody in the poorer half of the country was worse off than they were in 1999 and 1984, when you look at the averages for the bottom half of the country. So that was really a period, and I think that's the period he's talking about, when the income gains did go to people at the top. And yeah, and I do think these things have very long-lasting consequences. And this sort of comes back on the point that, you know, we're in a position not too different now to where we were in the early 2000s, albeit we've lost that progress, like I said, under Labour. These things have very, very long-lasting consequences. We know from the Dunedin Longitudinal Survey, for instance, that children who are born in poverty and who are in poverty throughout their childhood are much more likely to have major, major heart problems than the children of rich parents. But the children who are in poverty for some of their childhood and then escape it because their parents become wealthy during that time, they also have more problems than the children who were never poor. The same is true with reading rates. Kids who were poor at one point in their childhood never reach the same reading rates in sort of their late teens, early adulthood, as rich kids do. So even temporary poverty is very damaging for the people who grow up in it. And it's a bit, I think it's a bit like, I mean, you think about water quality and water pollution, you know, the issue that's in the news at the moment. If we dumped a whole ton of chemicals in a, you know, notional stream, say 20 or 30 years ago, and then really did nothing to get back to the situation before we'd done that, those chemicals continue to leach out and they continue to have damaging effects. They continue to poison life. And I think that is what we're facing with. And every day that we don't do something about these issues, every day that we don't do something about child poverty is another day of damage, you know, is another day wasted.
Can I just come in here? I mean, I just want to reflect that we're talking about this in third-party terms. We're not talking about the child that lives down the street that we know about, that we could actually interject into their lives to try and assist. So, again, going to the city mission, we spend our time walking with people. Now, we pay our staff to do that. We pay people to be involved in that, and they have to be highly qualified. But incumbent upon us all is to be part of this society and contribute to this society in a positive way. It's not a them problem, it's an us problem.
So on that particular note, Judge Andrew Beecroft, who is now the Children's Commissioner, said late last year that action needs to be taken or New Zealand risks relegating a third generation of children to a life of poverty. The rates of child poverty have got worse since the 1980s, he said, and he argued for a tax increase. I'm going to guess, Eric, that you would argue against that?
I think the first thing that you need to do if you want to address real hardship is start looking at housing costs. That won't solve everything, I know that, but it's the easiest, most obvious thing that we need to do. It's contributing substantially to real hardship. And I'm going to be blunt and a little ruder than I usually am. When I look around the room, I see things that look a lot like when I was at the Candela Town Hall meeting about a year and a half ago, where Wellington Council was proposing allowing increased density in Candela, where I live. And just the sea of objections there, of people who don't want change, don't want to allow more housing to be built, there's a direct connection between every time we do that in a town hall meeting when council wants more housing to be built and somebody who has to end up living in a car or a shed. Okay? Like, it's easy for us all to say, oh, well, let's make rich people pay for it. Let's increase taxes. Allow more housing to be built. Stop objecting at these damn meetings so that we can let council rezone so that more built houses can be built and fewer kids are going to be living in cars and sheds.
I absolutely agree that we need to be building more houses. And one of, I think, the best things that someone said about Auckland is that cities either have to go up or out. And in the last 30 years, Auckland has chosen to do neither of them, and that's not sustainable.
Yeah.
But I would, I mean, just on that Beecroft point about multiple generations, and picking up John's challenge about bringing individuals into this, one of the people I interviewed for my first book about inequality was a woman called Kelly, who was a solo mother in Auckland, and we called her story So Many Obstacles because she was absolutely trying to do the right thing by her kids, and yet life kept chucking the most enormous number of obstacles in their way. So, I mean, I won't go into the whole thing because it would take up too much time, but she was originally living in a house where the water was leaking up in through the carpet so much that your socks got damp when you walked on it. And she had a massive fight with the tenancy tribunal and won, but ended up having to move a long way south in Auckland. But she kept her kids at the local school because their education is really important. So she ended up travelling 4 hours a day, working in terrible jobs, very badly paid, where she was disrespected, treated like dirt. Actually ended up having a full-scale physical breakdown because of the stress of all of this, virtually not sleeping. Treated terribly by public authorities who messed up her tax credits by thousands of dollars, treated very badly by the private sector. At one point she had to ring Vodafone because her daughter was in she had to ring emergency services because her daughter was in terrible trouble. She couldn't get through on her mobile phone. She complained to Vodafone. They said, it's your fault for not having a landline, which is not the kind of treatment you get when you're a well-off person like I am. And there were just these extraordinary series of obstacles in her way. And you couldn't ask her to do more. You couldn't ask her to do more to try to ward off that next generation of poverty, which is what she doesn't want her parents, children to be brought up into. A lot of those things are very structural. They are about big picture decisions we've made about housing, about the quality of housing, about the lack of public transport, about pay rates, about the way people are treated in the benefit system. And dealing with those is going to be a massive society-wide effort, I think.
And for her, all of that creates a whole bunch of stress, which is bad for her health, makes her make bad decisions, probably, you know, because that's what people who are under stress do, and makes it that she's just not really having a very nice life.
No, and when she had this massive, this sort of complete physical breakdown, which I think was in 2011, the doctors described it looked as if she'd kind of had a full body chemical burn. Basically, the reaction that she underwent was so extreme.
And you know, take that story, Diane Robertson, who used to be the city missioner in Auckland, and again, Bill English repeats the story of the diary kept by a beneficiary. And if I recall rightly, that in 14 days, the beneficiary went to 27 different agencies and actually wrote down which was the one that treated her the best. And the one that treated her the best was the one that greeted her and gave her tea and coffee. And it was Instant Finance. Well, hold on, you laugh. You laugh. But that is the world. If you haven't got cash today, you want a payday loan, they're the ones you go to.
And they're the ones who treat you nicely.
Because they treat you nicely.
Yeah. And it's very easy for the four of us to sit here as middle class, hopefully not passing any aspersions on anyone, white people with educations. The three of you earn about 20% more than I'm likely to earn. But, you know, these things are worse if you are not white. Mm-hmm. They are worse if you're a woman. They are worse if you are young or old. They are worse if you are not of, if you're disabled in any way. This stuff is harder for people who aren't middle class white people.
And it's become harder in the last 4 years in terms of the work that we do at the mission. It has become infinitely harder. So that, for example, we run an alternate education school. We take children that no one wants to educate. So we can take up to 20 children a year. They used to come to us for about the age of 16. Now they come at 14, and the complexity that they bring with them is tenfold in comparison to what it was in terms of the difficulty of their living circumstance. So we can look after them during the day, but it's the environment that they then go back to in the evening, which is toxic in many cases.
Literally toxic in terms of water rising through carpet.
Water or methamphetamine, violence.
So what are you seeing as having driven that over the last 4 years?
A withdrawal of funding in terms of mental health.
Okay.
Without a doubt. And it's really hard to pinpoint it as to what is the single cause. But it's basically society withdrawing from looking after these people in communities. So we look at ourselves in isolated family units living behind our walls. And in reality, we're actually part of communities. And those communities are breaking down. And that's why the kids end up going as junior gang members.
When you do any of the family budgeting service stuff, how much of that is coming out of rent and accommodation costs?
Oh, it depends on which budgeting service we do, because we do there's two or three different sorts. So there's one where we actually educate you how to use your budget.
Yeah.
There's another one right at the other end, which is where we take all the money and we give you spending money. And that makes sure that the rent gets paid. I couldn't give you the percentage of what's going out. But a lot of them live on subsidised rents in varying different ways. And we try and maximise what they can get.
Yeah, the accommodation supplement hasn't quite kept up with Auckland rents, though. And if it did, rent would just go up by more. So,
one of the other things I think we're seeing, and that's probably contributing to that, John, is a very punitive line on beneficiaries. And I think because you sort of have to disentangle, you know, it's sometimes said that, you know, people sort of lazily say, at the moment, you know, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And by and large, that's not true. You know, there has been income growth even since the recession for people at the lower end of things. But I think within that, there's been a very, very, I would say, unpleasant line approach taken towards beneficiaries who are, you know, not incidentally disproportionately Māori and Pacifica. And, you know, if you talk to people, I talk to people at the Downtown Community Ministry, for instance, who you know well, and they're, their sort of caseload has doubled, you know, since the global financial crisis. And you look at the number of people who are rough sleeping, the number of food parcels that Salvation Army gives out. All those things have skyrocketed because Windsor's increasingly taking a very tough line, people turning people away as much as possible, sanctioning people. You know, the hundreds, of thousands of children who are in families where the parents have been sanctioned for whatever reason. And MSD has done no research about what effect that has had on those children. So within a picture that is not entirely dismal for people at the lower end, I think beneficiaries really are being singled out for particularly punitive treatment, and I think that contributes to what you're seeing.
I read the Facebook comments for a living. Yes, yes, they are. So then, whose job is it to fix this? Do we give a whack of money to the City Mission? Do we give more? What do we pay more benefits? Whose job is it to fix this? Eric, you look like you have a...
It's a big mix. I think that we do need to fix housing. I've gone on about that enough. Long term, we need to fix education as well. There are too many kids that are stuck in failing schools. The Auditor General had a report out last year looking at achievement among Maori in small rural schools, and the percentage of kids hitting national standards varied from about 25% to about 90% within that cohort of very schools serving all decile one similar small schools. But nobody talks about school performance. They'll hide it behind decile. We need to get better ways of assessing school performance for the long term so that kids don't end up trapped from poor education. We need to be looking at things like we're spending $600 million a year in interest write-offs for rich kids to go to university on 0% loans when that money should instead be going into lower decile schools that have a poor track record of getting their kids into tertiary education. $600 million a year is the cost of the interest write-offs.
I feel like this is the wrong room to raise that in.
Yeah, well, it's nice and feels good to advocate increased taxes, and of course your 0% loans don't hurt anybody. Well, come on, give your heads a shake. Rejig so that there's less middle-class welfare through 0% loans and more of it going to poor schools that need it. We need to make sure that the government is properly following up in its investment approach and doing the evaluation work that Max is pointing out isn't properly being done so that we can be sure that there's so much promise in that approach, using better data to see what kinds of government interventions work and also letting NGOs and the charitable sector come in and provide services that get evaluated to see whether they're helpful and useful.
It's a really nice idea. We don't currently have a measure of poverty. Do we? We don't say what poverty is.
You don't even need that to do that. What you can use is look at the individual interventions that are undertaken, what new programs are being tried, which community groups are helping somebody, and look at the outcomes for those specific people instead of aggregates, because we've got all the data in it already on the IDI.
But with due respect to that, that's at the bottom of the cliff. So society do we build fences at the top of the cliff to stop people falling down?
Fixing education, fixing housing.
But that's easy to say. But it's actually about the value we put on people's lives. It's about how we treat people. It's about, as a society, we actually don't do that very well. You know, some of the organizations I work for, I'm very passionate about the vision of the organization because it actually informs what we do. We don't actually have a vision for this country. We don't.
Can I just touch on the question of whose responsibility it is? I think Eric's right up to a point that there are multiple responsibilities. I would probably put more stress, though, on it being fundamentally a governmental responsibility. I mean, redistribution, is only government, can compulsorily redistribute. And also, I think...
So when you say redistribute, you mean tax?
Yeah, but I mean also a lot of measures that would, lead to a narrower kind of, gap in wages and salaries in the first place, so you don't have to do as much with tax and transfers. But I think the fundamental point is there are things which, needs that people have which they can fulfill in the market by buying things, and those are nothing to do with me. There are views about how communities want to run their local centres or how clean they want their streets to be, and that's not much to do with me. Whether people are basically surviving or not, whether they have enough to live on and live a life of dignity and participation, absolutely concerns me. I mean, I really care about that. I care about that outcome for every single one of my fellow New Zealanders. And so I think that is a responsibility that is fundamentally best addressed through government. And I think it's best addressed directly. Education is important, but most the biggest determinant of how well people do at school is their socioeconomic background. And I also think, you know, R.H. Tawney, the historian and writer, once said that a good society is not one in which people can rise. It's one in which people have a good life whether they rise or not. And rather than a lot of focus on education and, you know, helping people to break out of cycles of poverty, why don't we have a society in which everyone earns enough that they're not in poverty, regardless of what job they're doing? That would be my ideal. That would be my vision.
Can I just add one more point? Because I'm sitting here with a corporate hat on as well. And we haven't talked about the corporate sector and big business and the marketplace, and I'm sure many of you will have views on that. But I actually, leaving aside all your views on that, it does strike me that the corporate world is blind if it does not start to think about the customer of the future and the employee of the future. And if you look at some of the trends that you gentlemen are alluding to, it's going to be an interesting world 10, 20, 30 years out if we don't start to address some of the issues that you're talking about. Yet, let me tell you, trying to have that conversation in a boardroom, you may as well be talking to yourself. But it is a very significant issue about the customer of the future and the employee of the future.
Because the argument against what Max is saying is that some people should earn more because they do a more important job.
Well, or I don't think anyone's arguing for total equality.
Why not? Why not?
I feel confident saying that Eric isn't.
Are you arguing for universal income?
No, I'm not. No. Well, we could have a whole debate about that. I actually, possibly rare moment of total agreement, where I think Eric wrote a very good thing about the universal basic income a while back, saying, well, if I'm getting this right, it's a nice idea, but unworkable, really, yep. Unaffordable. I just think that, you know, a lot of things matter for a good life. Life is very complex, but having enough income and wealth is incredibly important for being able to lead the kind of life you want to lead. It is a core responsibility of all of us through government, I think, and this is a value judgment, you know, this isn't an objective one, these are my values, that it is on all of us to ensure through the welfare system that people do have the income they need to lead a life of dignity and participation. So I personally would be in favour of more generous benefits, not universal. You do have to have them clawed away as you earn more in order to keep it affordable, but more generous, remove a lot of the stigmatising sort of intrusion and questions and hoops that people have to jump through, because actually the evidence is, and the Morgan Foundation have recently put out a book about this, that in general terms, when you give people money, they spend it well. I mean, this is not true of everyone, and John, you'll deal with a lot of people, some people for whom this isn't true, but by and large, people know what they need to succeed and to thrive, and you provide them with the income, a lot of time people will make fantastic choices in their own lives.
I feel like a rare moment of agreement, because I feel like that is basically what we were just discussing before we started.
I'll agree with Max on that. At least
up to a point, probably.
Well, you're right about one big thing, that giving poor people money is better than, or that should be the benchmark against which everything else is assessed. That's one thing that seems to be missing in the investment approach trials. Like, they're running lots of different interventions through the Ministry of Social Development. Let's try this program, let's try that program, and see how things are compared to the status quo. Imagine another one where you just take a third of the people and give them the cash equivalent of whatever it costs to provide that service, and see whether the service does any good compared to just giving them the cash equivalent. If you can't beat giving them the cash equivalent...
And overseas experiences, conditional cash transfers that are linked to outcomes, are very powerful in poor urban and rural communities. And the World Food Programme is actually increasingly using electronic funds transfer as opposed to bringing local importing product, because if you bring cash into an economy, it stimulates the economy.
Yeah, that's definitely best on international charity. You should be going to like Give Direct, where you can just wire people money through their cell phone. You can make transfers to random draw people who've been assessed as needy, and they just get the money straight in their cell phone. It's about the best you can do if you want to be helping poor people abroad.
We could argue about that.
Well, Radio New Zealand has been under a funding freeze, hasn't it? So you're deserving.
I couldn't possibly comment. But that assumes that people have a cell phone.
Oh, in the developing world, it's huge. You know, huge cell phone penetration. In fact, it's way better than landlines because in corrupt, crappy countries, private cell phone companies deliver service and governments don't. Cell phones get around corrupt governments.
Or alternatively, the copper network was stolen.
That can happen, too.
Yeah. It also happens. It's also much, much cheaper in most developing countries to use your cell phone than it is in New Zealand. We've talked about whose job this is to fix. What we haven't talked about is who actually can fix it. So who has the power here? If you are a person on a fixed income paying half of your weekly income into rent and trying to send your kids to school, you are not the person necessarily with the way to get yourself out of that. Who does have it? You disagree with the fundamental thing that I've just said, Eric. Oh, look on your face.
No, I was just trying to think through it. I agree with Max that most people are making the best choices that they possibly can, given the circumstances that they're facing. They can get some help to occasionally see options that they might not have considered, but by and large, our expectation should be that people are making the choices right for them. What we can do is change some of the constraints. I think we have to do that around housing. I'll keep saying it. When you go to the town hall meeting around density, say, please let me have more neighbors. That is the single thing that you personally can do to stop blocking housing affordability. Please do it. I put in a submission for Candela. I want more neighbors. Okay. You can do that. We can insist that the government start actually running the evaluations that they've been talking a lot about on the investment approach to see whether that's doing any good. And we can ask that cash transfers be the appropriate comparison so we know whether just giving people money works better. I think it probably does in a lot of cases, but it's worth testing. I think we need to have more pressure on the education system. That's, again, longer term. Think more on these.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a complex one. At the risk of sounding incredibly corny, I mean, we all have the ability to change the situation in some small way. I mean, and because, you know, because I have the value judgment that a lot of this is on us acting through government, I think, you know, talking about these issues, talking about inequality, having conversations around it, voting, mobilising, organising, all those things are really important. But, you know, long-term and difficult. In the short term, I met someone once who... a young woman who, as a result of reading a lot about inequality, had become very concerned. And her solution was to go... She was from a relatively wealthy Auckland suburb. Her solution was to go into one of the poorer ones and just work with some of the kids in sort of the reading programs in the library on Saturdays. And that was as much about connection as anything. And I think one of the big problems with inequality in an unequal society is that people live very far apart from each other. Rich and poor become very segregated, and people lose that sort of empathy, that trust, that sense of other people's lives. And so one of the things that I think would be most useful is if we could create structures in which people start to see more of how the other half live, and that would be in terms of housing. I think that would involve trying to design housing systems where you have social housing dotted in amongst rented housing and owner-occupied housing, so you've got that kind of social mixing. But I think we can probably all do things in our own lives to try to expose ourselves more to lives that are different to ours and try to better understand how the other half lives.
Which is what, as a Christian, one is called to do, to love your neighbour as yourself.
But
what if your neighbours are all like you?
then let me finish that with a story. A friend of mine who is very wealthy in Auckland was driving through Auckland about 6 months ago with his three children. Eldest daughter was 16 and said, "Dad, I've been reading about this 1%. What does it mean?" So they had a conversation in the car, and by the end of the car journey, they had resolved as a family that they were part of the 1%. They knew that, and that this year they were going to help 99 people.
Wow.
So think about that.
If you own a house in Auckland.
Well, they were part of a very active church, so there was the opportunity to work through the church into different places. there's the opportunity. I know Roy Ferguson's here today. He goes doing reading assistance in Wainui Mata, you know, helping kids to get, lift their reading age. I mean, there are a plethora of ways you can do it. And if all else fails, give some money to the city mission.
I am not to bring it back to Jim Bolger a second time, but I'm going to anyway. One of the other things he said at the very end of an hour-long interview with Guy Onespinner was the thing he thinks we can better do to improve society. What he said is, listen to the people at the margins, which goes back to your very original point, which is listen to the people who are actually suffering or who are somehow marginalised. Listen to them and maybe we might learn some things.
It's easy to love the lovable. It's actually not very easy to love the unlovable or the unloved.
And that explains why I'm single. who has a question on that note? Someone must. There we go, over the back there.
Yep. I have two questions actually, and so I'll get them really quickly. Do any of you know why beneficiaries have to pay tax? That's one. And the second is, how can we get the government to put mental health back into the health vault? Without them expecting them to be super, evaluated and accountable?
I've got a good answer on the first one. The second one is hard. The good answer on the first one is that you keep a clean tax system by charging tax on everybody no matter what their income and then paying beneficiaries more than you otherwise would have if the benefit were tax-free. If the benefit were tax-free, they'd be giving beneficiaries less. On mental health, that's damn hard, and I don't have good answers.
Does everyone at the table agree with the first answer?
It makes sense.
Good. Yes. Okay, cool. Does anyone else have a mental health answer? I can tell you that look out for some Radio New Zealand reporting in the next 2 months. But other than that?
They were trying some innovative stuff in social sector trials around social bonds a little while ago. They are trying to... They're picking sort of the easy stuff, so... People with had fairly minor mental health issues that wanted to be back in the labor force and trying to find ways of reintegrating them into the labor force. The first attempt at a social bond on that fell over. The second attempt went through. I understand some of the concerns around measurement and evaluation, and we have to be careful in how we select the measures so that we're not doing harm. But we risk doing far less good than we could if we're not measuring and evaluating properly.
I think the work around social investment, when I last looked at it, was very, very positive.
Yeah.
And certainly, from an actuarial point of view, made an awful lot of sense. But I don't know. It seems to be lost in the system at the moment. And you have to take risks. And the problem in politics is... No one wants to take a risk because it will be held against you at a later date. But anything to do with investment, by definition, is a risk. Anything to do with social investment is a risk. Yet we have to try pilots.
Yeah.
We have to be willing to fail to succeed.
I'm going to jump in and reinforce that really strongly. The whole approach there was keyed towards getting outcome accountability. But because politicians are paranoid about something screwing up along the way,
yeah.
And then voters getting really, really mad, okay, we've taken a risk and tried this new thing that has a lot of promise, and we want to see if it works. You wind up with a John Campbell special on
yeah.
one case where it didn't work, and then everybody demanding the head of the minister. And because of that, ministries wind up layering on top of outcome measures just a ton of process measures that should just be left to the NGO that's trying to figure out how to help people, right? Because that's the whole point of moving to an outcomes approach. That because the ministers are scared of you guys demanding their heads, if one thing goes wrong in an innovative program, be more flexible around risk when government is trying to do some of these things with charitable sector.
How great would it be to see a politician say, we tried this thing, didn't work, we're going to try something else?
I mean, there is the other argument as well, which needs to be understood, that if you ask an NGO to do something and say, will you report back, we have had programs at the City Mission that cost the same amount of money to report back as the money we got to do the program.
Yeah.
And we don't get funded for the report back.
And that's where the government really could be helping, especially with the IDI. So setting this up properly, all the government should need to know is who is being helped by the NGO.
and what outcomes that the government is already measuring the NGOs trying to help with. Like, reemployment is easy because they've got tax records on everybody. They know who's got a job and who doesn't. There should be nothing on the NGO other than saying who we've helped over what period.
Impact.
Yeah, and then leave it to Stats New Zealand and the IDI and the Social Investment Unit to do the evaluation. But they need to fund a few more analysts over in the Social Investment Unit to do that.
I mean, can I just say something? I agree with a lot of that. I also think, though, there's a risk that we criticize, well, right, we need to criticize government where it's ineffective, but we also shouldn't think that we need to accept government being as imperfect as it is. I mean, you come back on the, you know, the number of times that you have to explain your story to government agencies. Well, you can have joined up government. The sort of the way that people, the fact that people hate dealing with wins. Well, in other countries, you know, going to the job seeker's office or whatever is, well, I mean, it's never wonderful, but it can be an okay process. And, you know, all these things we can demand and we can expect really good joined up government and even innovative government. So there, I mean, in the UK, for instance, they've had schemes where they say, okay, we don't actually know how to deal with a particular health problem. We will allow all the regional health authorities to experiment for a year with different methods of treatment. We'll gain the lessons from that. And then whatever works, we will then roll out as mandatory.
But you're saying the same thing.
But you need one for the other. You need to be able to say this didn't work to be able to experiment like that.
You have to have a public that is tolerant of failure in government.
Yes.
Yep, and that is difficult. And sorry, and just very quickly, I feel like we haven't addressed the second question very well. I don't honestly actually know what that's a political pressure answer, but I suspect it is about telling the stories. I mean, as John says, stories are very powerful. Telling the stories of people who are being failed by the mental health system. I think a lot of that is happening in the People's Inquiry. I suspect if you keep that up, you will see more change. I would hope so anyway.
The interesting byproduct of the new health and safety is that we run a drop-in centre where we have volunteers. And the volunteers are now quoting the new health and safety legislation to us to say that it could be unsafe to work in an environment where there are mental health patients. When you go,
That's exactly...
But that is exactly what the legislation does.
Yep. You see that pervasively across all kinds of risk-taking.
I'm just citing one example.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, you should probably ask for another question.
Do you want to do the job or yet?
Yeah. No. I just saw some hands.
There seems to be a lot of consensus on the table that non-governmental organisations need more funding for this job. I would say, why? Why shouldn't we have the government doing all the things? If you have non-government organisations that are helping people, or maybe you have a church, do you know that they're going to help people of a different religion that's not Christian? Do you know that? How do you know, as somebody who wants social outcomes to improve, as a private citizen, I might say, well, I might donate to this charity, but I haven't heard of that other one, and they're actually doing loads of good, but I didn't want to hear of them, so I wouldn't have given them money. Why can't we just have government do all of this stuff and take it out of our taxes and let private charity work where it wants to, but not put the responsibility onto it and say it's government's collective duty to do this as New Zealanders for the whole of society and not just throw it at some random charities?
Can I answer
that? Question, yeah.
I mean, I think that I'll make 2 points. One is the term customer service doesn't transfer to the private public sector very well. And I know because I've done talks in the public sector about what are the lessons you can learn from the finance, from ASB, for example, or from other places where customer service is measured and people rewarded according to customer service. So I would say in the NGO sector, customer service is actually just an ethos of what that organisation is about, because they're dealing with people all the time. You're not dealing in a product, you're dealing with a person. But the second thing which sort of does strike me is that people who work in the NGO sector see this as a calling. Invariably, this is something that they feel they're called to go and do. They're not employed. This is a vocation, which is a very different philosophy. Now, I'm generalising terribly. Sorry?
A teacher would argue the same thing.
I absolutely agree. No, I completely agree with a teacher and with a nurse, with a doctor, I would agree. But to actually think that NGOs don't have a role to play would be quite an extreme outcome, I would have thought.
I would have a slightly contrary view, perhaps not surprisingly. And when I said, when I was talking about agreement previously, I really meant about evaluation of programs, whatever you're doing. I personally pretty reluctant about the idea of an expanding role for NGOs in delivering public services. I think, not least because I think the more you do that as an NGO, the more you just start to look like the public sector anyway, and the more you compromise your independence from government. I think the role of NGOs has been to help communities build community capital, to provide, you know, forms of socialising, and to be a voice for people, for standing up for individuals who couldn't represent themselves in wider debate. I think what we should be demanding is, like I said, is really excellent government. And there are places, you know, like children's centres in the UK, the Sure Start centres, are absolutely fantastic, really amazing innovation, and totally government run. You know, we can have fantastic, I would say, citizen service, not customer service. We can have fantastic citizen service in government because it happens in other countries. The reason it doesn't happen here is because the people doing it, they want to be helpful, but often are being instructed effectively not to be. WINS is a horrible punitive place to go because that is the command that is coming down from on high. There is no reason we can't have really fantastic citizen-centred government, and that would, yes, that would be absolutely what I'd support.
I'm more on the other side on this one. Although I totally take the point about charities risking being subsumed by government and being part of the state, that's a difficult line. I think that it's more ably handled when government focuses on outcomes rather than on process. I think there's a lot of innovation that comes from the private sector that we don't see coming out of government. And I think it provides another line of accountability where just imagine what changes in the power dynamic between the minister and the ministry if they know that an NGO is able to get a single mother with poor educational background into long-term employment for this kind of program cost, and MSD has only ever been able to do it for 10 times the price. Once you start getting that in, the information silos that the ministries have huge information advantages over the ministers, and they can use that to kind of bludgeon the ministers and subvert some of what government wishes to do through democratic processes. You open that up when there is contestability in service delivery financed by government and outcome measurement. I think there's huge promise in where the government is going on the investment approach, but it does take the outcome evaluation.
I think the one other valid role for an NGO is that it can legitimately advocate on behalf of the least, the lost, who cannot advocate on their own behalf. They're absolutely unable to. And it would be difficult to see that being done within a government service.
I wouldn't want to stop NGOs from doing that. I'm just questioning this.
But imagine ramping it up one step further. If charitable organizations that weren't government funded even, but wanted to know the good they were doing, were able to go to the social investment unit and say, these are the clients we're helping, find us people who are very similar to them in the background statistics and see whether we are doing good, to get a seal of approval on effectiveness that we would know when we contribute to charities that we're contributing to ones that make a real difference. That's another great thing government could be doing there.
Such an economist, you want to know numbers.
Well, yeah, the effective altruism movement is really important.
I'm going to go that way because I've done all the middle.
Instead of making out people with numbers, because we're an investment, we're not a risk.
think a lot of the framing around the investment approach has been backwards. And I think it's partially because it came out of the finance ministry. And I think it's mostly a terminological thing, but hopefully it hasn't turned into the way the ministries are dealing with it. They've been framing it in terms of cost reduction for the state, but that isn't the objective, I think, and hope. The objective is improving people's lives, and a consequence of that is that they are not going to be dependent on the state for as many cash transfers, and that they will have... If everything works perfectly, we're trying to figure out which programs are able to alleviate hardship, and where government money goes in already to paying people who are in hardship, the more that you do to reduce hardship, the more that you do to reduce the amount that the government is having to pay. The focus should be on the hardship alleviation. And that's what some of these outcome targets should be, right? Measuring, have you successfully improved people's lives in the way that you said you're going to do? That's how it should be being evaluated.
Can I just say, I'm very, very sorry to hear about the abuse you've suffered and the fact that you also don't feel valued at the moment. And thank you for sharing your story as well, because I know that takes courage in front of an audience. I guess we've spent a lot of this evening talking about the numbers and the dollars. I mean, like I said earlier, that's far from the only thing that matters for a good life. But I guess it's coming... I mean, there have been centuries of debate about these things because we know that life is very difficult if you don't have the resources. And that's one of the most basic things that we can try to do for each other, is ensure that everyone at least has the resources to get by. I completely agree that that shouldn't devolve into seeing people only as numbers and figures, and I think, you know, things like social investment, I don't think are bad in themselves, but it would be very bad if they became the masters. You know, those tools should be in the service. They can be very valuable tools, but they need to be in the service of something higher, something about values, whatever your values are. And I mean, I would hope that the values that those sort of government programs are in service of are ones around compassion, around empathy, around support for others, around doing unto others as you would have done unto you. And I would hope that through whatever means we can, you know, in the future build much better systems and better systems of support and better communities, to come back on John's point, that will hopefully offer you the support that you obviously haven't had.
John,
I can only reiterate Max's comments. I think it's very brave of you to speak. I suppose, tragically, it just reiterates the point I was saying, which is it's the one in front of you, it's the person. And we all have an opportunity to impact someone, somewhere, that we're not doing today. It's hard. It's really hard. It's inconvenient. It takes time. But that's how we actually change the fabric of society, by recovering back what you see if you go to third world countries, which are vibrant communities. We don't have the vibrant communities that you see in some of the African nations. They've got tons and tons and tons of issues, but their community spirit is quite astonishing. There's a lady there that... Not only do they take money away, but they take away the term funding. So they take your 3-year funding and turn it into 1-year funding with a promise that we might review it. I agree. It's really hard to run an investment level approach.
This was going to be my final question, but I'm going to ask it now because it answers both of these questions. It's an election year. It's 27 days, not that I'm counting down or anything, to an election. So how does everyone in this room make their voice heard, potentially other than just on election day? What, how do, you know, if they're going to a town hall meeting, what do they say? Not just, I want more neighbours, there's going to be other things. Anyone can take this one.
I think it's very hard for everyone, for anyone to have all the issues on the table. I think each of us are likely to have something in our heart that we're passionate about. And that becomes the thing that we then start to persevere with. And we persevere, and we persevere, and we persevere, and that is how change takes place. It's up to the individual to decide what is that issue for you. It's going to be different to me, but what is the one that gets you awake at night? What is the one that you lie and are angry about, that you think, in 30 years' time, what will they say? Why did you let that happen? That's my comment.
Well, just to sort of answer directly that last question as well, I think it's very true, and unfortunately there's, you know, we're supposed to have evidence-based policy in this country, but too often we have, you know, policy-based evidence. We listen to the evidence that suits the policy. And you're absolutely right. Stuff that works gets scrapped. Teachers know all about this because there's any number of reading programs have been really successful and then scrapped. And there's a lot of reasons for that, unfortunately, to do with, you know, politics and people wanting to make their mark on a particular ministry and the rest of it. In terms of affecting, you know, the election and making voice heard, I'm quite a big fan of the old-fashioned town hall meeting. I organised one for the mayoral campaign in Wellington last year, which was packed to overflowing, because they're great, because you really get a chance to actually put pressure on politicians one-on-one. And, you know, and I mean, anyone can organise one, or they can look for a community group in their area, a pressure group, a church, a trade union, whatever, who's organising one, and get on board with that. Because that's a moment where you can really make your voice heard very directly.
There's all of that. So far, it looks like Labour's got the most credible plan on housing, but we'll see how things develop. I think turning more of those kinds of town hall meetings into yes in my backyard things from not in my backyard things is incredibly important, because, again, when housing is broken, everything else just gets so messed up and everything else gets harder. And I understand and appreciate the importance of what we've been talking about for recognizing the faces behind the numbers, but we have to simultaneously recognize that we will do no good for the faces if we don't understand what programs really are effective, and that we should be demanding that kind of accountability from our government. Like, in everything, every other good and service we consume, we know what value for money we're getting, and we, like, you hold your accountant to account for actually producing stuff if you need an accountant, your architect, whatever good or service you're buying, you hold them to account for the service they're providing. But we're not demanding the same kind of accountability on government, that they're achieving the things that they are telling us they want to achieve. I think we're getting towards that in the investment approach. I think that ultimately it has to be to the benefit of the faces that have to be helped. But we have to demand that the outcome evaluation be done rigorously, and that it be focused on outcomes rather than layering process on that ruins it for the charitable sector when they're trying to help people who need help.
I have another one, and that is that I'm going to publicly state an opinion. No, I'm not. I'm going to publicly state a thing. We need more voices in this world, not fewer. And one of the things that has happened in our world is that the voices that we hear fewer voices louder. And we talk about this in social media. We talk about the tyranny of the few. So the people who comment on your Facebook posts, there's maybe 300 of them. The stuff commenters, stuff won't tell us how many commenters there are, but there's not nearly as many as it makes it look. There are a few people with really loud voices, and the more of us with really loud voices, the better, because they start listening when you have a really loud voice. So talk out loud would be my suggestion. One more question.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I'm a minister too, I'm a Presbyterian minister, being a youth worker, and I've had those struggles with funding, about how governments always want to have new programs, even if the old programs seem to affect and work well. And you started off the talk suggesting that this was an important narrative from America. We haven't really touched much on that,
yeah.
But I had a kind of different thought. I thought actually what is happening, this is what I hear the most, is that the housing crisis,
yep, totally.
Whatever we want to talk about, is almost the last straw of our egalitarian understanding of who we are as Kiwis. Like, there's this thing about owning your own house. For whatever thing, it's in our DNA as a myth or a truth, right? And you said before about vision, about what's our vision as a country. And some of that's been tied up in that understanding of egalitarianism, yep, as well. And I kind of get a sense that people are unhappy that is no longer who we are. And so my question is, how can political parties potentially, I'm not sure how this works because you all up there don't agree, so where's the room or the scope for multi-party kind of work on this? Because if we all, like Jim or John, sorry,
John.
If John was saying we all have to give a little, we have to, yeah, give to make this happen, what are our parties giving? How do they give across policy?
That has
and
been so frustrating.
To make this work.
Yeah.
Not make it a point of getting into government, but make it a point of getting our country back to where we want it to be.
I love
where's
the vision.
That, where's that conversation?
The think tank that I work with has been doing years of work on housing affordability and local government financing, and how ultimately it comes down to how local government is financed and how infrastructure is financed. Yeah, you're shaking your head, but that's what's driving. No, not you. Councils would make different decisions if they had different skin in the game on the funding that goes around housing. What's been really frustrating is watching some of the flip-flops around it, where National has previously said, okay, well, let's allow more subdivisions as part of the solution. That's part of it, along with allowing more density. Labor comes up with a plan to do that, along with David Seymour and United Future, Peter Dunn, and then National votes against it. Okay, so that is just stupid. There is hope that the Productivity Commission's recommendations around housing affordability form the basis for cross-party agreement. Phil Twyford is sane on a lot of these issues. He sees the problems in housing supply. I disagree with him some stuff around demand, but that's neither here nor there. He sees the importance of getting more housing built and some of the incentive problems in making that be in council's interest. I think there's basis for agreement between Labor, Greens, and ACT on some of this stuff, and National possibly could be brought in, but...
Is there room for, in 2009, the government held a job summit and they got a whole bunch of really smart people from lots of different parts of the community, from business and the NGO sector and a whole bunch of things to talk about jobs, and what came out of it was the cycleways, I think, was what in the end came out of that. But is it time for a housing summit? Is there time for to just get a whole lot of people into a room and actually talk about what's going on here? Because what seems to be happening is, I mean, it took until not that long ago for people to admit that this was a crisis.
Well, we came so damn close, and that's just been so disappointing. We had, as of about a year ago, we had reasonable consensus on that housing supply was the problem, that we needed to ease up on the density restrictions within town and on subdivisions on the outside of town to let people build, maybe rejig some infrastructure financing to help let that happen. In the last month, it's turned back into blaming immigrants for everything. And I've not run out of used car dealers or haircuts or anything else because of the migrants buying everything. It's only the thing that council won't let you build more of that you're running out of, and that's housing. Okay, we need to get the conversation back around to allowing more housing. The Productivity Commission's report, I think, is important in that. I like to think that we did a bit of important stuff too, but the PRODCOM is going to be the basis for a lot of it too. Differences between us are second order. But recognizing the importance of allowing more density even near you in substantially alleviating real hardship.
Can I just... I would absolutely agree that something like a housing summit could be really useful. Just in direct response to your question, two things. One, very quickly, you have to be careful about that notion of egalitarianism, because New Zealand, I would argue, certainly had you know, much smaller income inequality for our world beating rise in the 80s and 90s, but that was only inequality that was offered to some. I mean, it wasn't an inequality for women who had very limited career opportunities, for Māori whose culture was being suppressed, and I'm sure you know all of that, but that sometimes they get lost in the public debate. So I'm all up for a forward-looking egalitarianism. What would it mean to forge egalitarianism in the 21st century, not a backwards-looking one? The thing about your question about politics is absolutely right. It would be great to see a lot more consensual work. I suspect that probably needs a different kind of politics and a much more what people call participatory politics. We're all doing it ourselves, rather than representative politics where you leave the decisions up to politicians. Because there's lots of really good practical examples. Citizens' assemblies, citizens' juries in other countries. You get ordinary people together with expert opinion. You pay them for their time over a couple of days. They come up with amazing policy. That policy that commands 80% consensus amongst a representative group of ordinary people. That is an amazing process, and I would love to see a lot more of that. And I think if we had more of that, we'd get a much more consensual politics than we have now.
John, can I get you? Okay.
Well, I don't feel I can really add to it because I absolutely agree with the question. I mean, where is the vision that's going to bring this country together? And these are mechanisms.
All right. Well, it's an election year.
The vision has to be a place where people can afford their own damn houses.
No,
as part of it.
It's where they have a fullness of life.
Or maybe it's not.
That's the grand one.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that what a vision is?
Yeah.
It's grand.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a place where people can rent a house that they want to live in for 20 years, and they don't have to afford their own damn house.
Yep.
Anyway, we'll do one more question. Yep.
Housing, is it a Wanganui issue as well as the Auckland one? Just narrowing that.
It does vary considerably. So you've got substantial hardship in Northland that has nothing to do with housing costs in Northland because it's cheap to live in Northland. Auckland is affected by Auckland housing because people aren't moving from Northland to where jobs are because they can't afford to live there. So that's messing things up for broader swaths of the country than you'd see on the first stats. Wellington costs are going up. Christchurch has come down since Selwyn and Waimakariri have really come on stream and consenting after the earthquakes, something we weren't able to do in Auckland because of the stupid Unicity proposal that merged everything. It's largely Auckland, has spillover effects elsewhere. Costs are rising through then in Hamilton and bedroom suburbs. It's coming into Wellington, hasn't been seen so much down Dunedin yet.
One brief thing I'd add on the housing question is that we shouldn't forget the role of government in this. We have the same number of state houses now that we had in 1991, which means that on a population-adjusted basis, we effectively we're 20,000 down on where we'd be if we kept the number of state houses growing in line with population. And I think it's noticeable that the 41,000 people who are officially homeless in New Zealand, who are in a variety of substandard forms of accommodation, you could probably house all of those people in the 20,000 state houses that we effectively haven't built over the last period. So that's something to be thinking about.
I think you also have to recognise we're a country that we save through second, third, fourth and fifth homes. That's our savings mechanism.
Yes.
And you look at the tax regime around that, and I don't want to go there because we're just opening up a whole night of conversation.
Yeah, Eric already mentioned immigration and we skid straight past
that. No, but you know, the tax regime is biased towards certain asset classes and not other asset classes. And we use that. And it happens to be housing that it's in favour of.
That doesn't change the number of houses. It changes owner versus renting. The blockage in getting more housing built is something else.
Yeah, but if you've got four houses, you can only buy one. So doesn't that affect supply by three more coming back potentially? It must by mathematically.
I agree with Megan on this one, that we probably denigrate renting a little more than we should.
I agree. Totally agree.
That at least there's really good American evidence that home ownership can lock you into places far from jobs too often. So if job markets change, if you own a house, it's harder to move closer to your new job, so you can wind up unemployed longer. There's really good evidence on that. Hmm. The problem is more than that. Well, part of the tax issue is that you get a bunch of sort of amateur landlords, but there are other... We won't get into that.
Allowing
more housing to be built.
We'll do a whole extra housing one.
Because whether you've got your outgoings in mortgage or in rent, you still have the money that you can't use for food.
I will tell you that I did a very informal survey about what people cared about. This was the Radio New Zealand audience, social media audience, essentially. So completely unscientific, completely informal. The three things about 8,000 people identified that they cared about in this election were housing, inequality of some measure, and clean water. So I feel like we're doing a fairly good job of telling those stories.
Yeah. Well done.
Thanks.
Well done. That's good.
Thank you all for coming. If I haven't met you before, please do pop up and introduce yourself. If I have met you before, please pop up and if I forget, remind me of who you are and say hi. Please join me in thanking our panelists and moderators. I hope that leaving tonight, you might know a bit more about what inequality is, how it works, what we might do about it. In terms of making your voice heard, the final event in our election series is a town hall or a hustings, where we'll have members and ministers of parliament over at Central Baptist Church on Mulcat Street. And the first part will be a moderated question and answer, which will take questions that have emerged in the four events, of which this is one, throughout the series, and the end part of which will be open to the floor, where you can ask your representatives or representatives of the parties who are asking for your vote, how do things stand on your view with inequality? Are you willing to take risks to improve our country, even if it means you'll lose your seat in the parliament? You can ask those kinds of questions and get those kinds of answers. So please do stay tuned and turn up for that. Please thank David and our, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Lydia.
They were our servers this evening. Inequality, the solution starts here. Tip your servers. We hope to see you next month across the way on Willis and Dixon. We'll be talking about things like clean water as we talk about climate crisis in the context of the upcoming election. Thanks again. We'll see you soon.
Thanks,
Megan.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing that.
Well done.